Okay, so Pentateuch. So to back up and set the stage, because my notes say we were partly through chapter 48. The big story in the latter part is the story of Joseph. And you remember, we've pretty much gone through Joseph's story, this great drama where, you know, he gets preferential treatment from his father. His brothers are jealous, sell him into slavery in Egypt. God uses him to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. He's given this position of great authority in which he saves up food during the 7 years of plenty and then is selling it during the years of famine to keep the country alive and even selling to other countries. And that's where he comes in contact with his brothers again. And you remember the great story, they come in to buy food and they don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And he treats them kind of harshly. Enough so that he gives Simeon a little bit of his own medicine and has him in prison for a year because he says, I don't want you guys coming back here unless you bring that other brother, you know, because he wants to see his brother Benjamin. Eventually, you know, even though Jacob doesn't want to let Benjamin go, they talk him into it. Judah takes responsibility for Benjamin. And Jacob tries to pull a fast one is the right way to say it, but he does this clever ruse of putting his silver cup in Jacob's bag and then sends the servants out saying, how dare you steal, and whoever stole it, he's going to be my servant. But all of them come back. And one of the things I like to point out is that their attitudes and their character, I think, has changed a lot since the time they sold Joseph into slavery. Now they're not willing to abandon one of their brothers, whether or not he gets preferential treatment from dad. And they're all willing to be servants. Then Judah goes out on a limb and explains the whole story and says, yo, look, make me a slave, I'm not sure if he says take my life, but he makes it clear that he became surety for Benjamin. At this point, Joseph can't handle the emotion anymore, sends out the Egyptians and starts crying and reveals himself to his brothers and reveals there's 5 more years of famine. So in the end result is go get the rest of the family and bring them down here. And then Jacob is reunited with his long-lost son. They're settled in Goshen. Pharaoh's very favorable to this family of Joseph. Joseph's a national hero. Everybody loves him. And so they go on. You could say they live happily ever after. In a sense, they do. And that's the end of the main part of Joseph's story. But then towards the end of Jacob's life, you know, he wants to talk to his sons and specifically wants to talk to Joseph and see Joseph's sons, his grandsons. So at the beginning of chapter 48, we see where Joseph gets word, your father's ill. You know, and it's implied he wants to see you. So Joseph goes and brings his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And Jacob's kind of amazed, like, wow, you know, I didn't think I'd see you again because I thought you were dead. Now I'm seeing your sons. And he says, bring them here and I'll bless them. And so that's where it begins. And verses 3 through 7, I made the point that he basically gives Joseph the birthright in place of Reuben. And you remember we looked at 1 Chronicles chapter 5 at the start of that. It says that Reuben lost the birthright because he went and committed adultery with one of Jacob's concubines. And that cost him. Joseph was given the birthright, which includes a double portion. And so Joseph's two sons are moved up in rank, you know, with the other sons of Jacob. And so Ephraim and Manasseh are counted as tribes in Israel. And that's about where we left off. Actually, so I had my note that we were going to start in verse 8. It says, Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, who are these? And, well, they're my sons that God's given me. So he said, bring them here and I'll bless them. The eyes of Israel were dim with age, he couldn't see. This seems to be the same problem that Isaac had had. Remember when Isaac wanted to give a special blessing to Esau and Jacob put on the goat skin on his arms and Rebekah fixed the meal the way he wasn't blind, but he couldn't see very well. And most scholars think this was probably cataracts. And I think when I talked about that, I mentioned when I went through that, I learned what it's like. You can see shapes, but things get really blurry. By the way, it was Genesis 27 where we had that story of Isaac and then Jacob stealing the birthright. But anyways, Joseph brings them up. So Joseph brought them beside his knees and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And he brought them forward with Ephraim in his right hand. Ephraim is the younger. So if it's on Joseph's right hand, it's Jacob's left hand. And Manasseh, so Jacob would put his right hand on him. Manasseh is the oldest. So But in that culture, of course, the right hand would be considered to confer the greater blessing. So the right hand is supposed to go on the eldest son's head. Okay, so he leads them up that way. And verse 14, Israel, which is the God-given name for Jacob, stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head. So he's putting his right hand on the younger, you know, so he and puts his left hand. So the famous thing, he crosses his hands, which it's not a symbol of the cross. It's just he's showing preference to the younger. Excuse me. And it says he did it knowingly. He knew what Joseph had done, and he starts pronouncing the blessing. And God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all these days. And I don't want to read, it's kind of poetic, but in verse 17, Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, and it displeased him. And not so, oh, how dare you bless Ephraim. But it's like, well, Dad, you got it backwards. This one's the elder. And that's what he tells him. He said, this one's the firstborn, put your right hand on his head. His father refused. I know, my son, I know. He shall become a people, he also shall become great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants will become a multitude of nations. That multitude of nations might sound familiar. That was among the promises that God gave to Jacob back in Genesis 35, verse 11, where he said, I'll make you a nation and a multitude of nations. And when I say, well, what does that mean? Well, this indicates that it wasn't necessarily just referring to the 12 tribes, each of whom would become a nation. And it does seem that that became true, and we'll talk about that in the next chapter. But he says specifically that Ephraim alone will become a company of nations. Or, which way did I put it? Yeah, multitude. Different translations use a different word. We don't know why God chose to put Ephraim first. We don't think it was just Jacob being cantankerous old man, I'm going to make the younger ahead. It seemed to be God's will. Why? I have no idea. It seems to follow a pattern, though. Remember, Jacob was younger than Esau, but Jacob got the preferential treatment. Going before that, Isaac was younger than Ishmael, but God made sure that Ishmael was the one getting it. So, I don't know, if you're a firstborn and your younger brother or sister seems to be getting better off than you, sorry, that doesn't always work that way. I remember I've got a sister who's 2 years older than me, and she did complain that she got in trouble more than I did. Then again, well, there were a lot of years that I was very jealous of my sister, so it goes both ways. Now, let's make the point, because here we believe that Ephraim was the descendants of the British peoples in Massa, America. And I'm not going to go through all the way we support that. We'll talk about it again later. You might remember I mentioned two methods are often used. One I get from Mr. Stiver, he calls tribe tracking, which is a cool way of saying it, tracing the history through time. The other method we like to call the artillery method, where it's like a cannon going off and then you see the explosion and you don't see what happened in between. But if we look at prophecy and then fulfillment, you assume that that's what it was. So, like I said, I'm not going to go through that. Some people say, well, obviously this is wrong because Manasseh is much greater than Ephraim. The United States is richer and more powerful than England is. Has that ever crossed your mind? Didn't mine. And the answer I would give is you have to look a little bit further back in history. For one thing, the Ephraimite, the peoples, if we talk about a company of nations, we would say England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and there's probably some others I'm missing. And I'm aware some people said, yeah, but the United States has North Carolina, South Carolina, Pennsylvania. You know, some people have interpreted it that way. And maybe when Christ returns, he'll say, yeah, they were right, Frank, and you were wrong. But until that happens, I think this way is right. I think the company of nations was Ephraim. And I'll say it's not just me saying I'm right. Studying in history, one of the things I realized is we have an egocentric view of history. Right now, the United States is more wealthy and powerful. But if you look back over the course of the last 200 or 300 years, Great Britain and the British Empire was much stronger and more wealthy for a longer period of time. And that's hard for us as Americans to accept, but you know, Great Britain and the British Empire for many years was the superpower, the geopolitical dominant force. And back when the United States was nothing, and even when the United States became something, Britain still kept a lot. So, and I don't want to go further in that, but I just thought I'd make the point, because it, our instinct is to say, no, it must have been the other way around. But history does support this interpretation. Okay, moving ahead, unless anyone has questions. In verse 20, I want to read, "So he blessed them that day and said, 'By you Israel will bless,' saying, 'May God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh.' And he said, 'Ephraim before Manasseh.' And Israel said to Joseph, 'Behold, I'm dying, but God will be with you.'" Okay, actually, I left something out. Yeah, it's back up in verse 16. I commented on this when we last had class, where he said, "Bless the lads, let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude of nations." The "let my name be named on them" pertains to the adoption. Like, formally, he's making them his sons rather than grandsons, we believe. But it also seems perhaps to be an indication of how we might interpret prophecy. There are many prophecies that name the name of Israel or Jacob, that this might be telling us those prophecies especially pertain to the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. And that's one of the reasons I'll look at prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and sometimes say this is about us, you know, the English-speaking peoples, more than even the rest of Northwestern Europe. Well, I wouldn't necessarily exclude them, but this seems to tell us to look more at these peoples. That makes sense? And I'm guessing many of you have heard this before, right? Something we used to hear in the church more often. Okay, down to verse 21, he said, "Behold, I'm dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers." No indication that Jacob had any fear of dying. He was just looking forward to what was coming next. I think, you know, by this time he was close enough to God, he had at least a fair bit of understanding of the resurrection. He hadn't read 1 Corinthians 15 because Paul hadn't written it yet, but I think he knew, you know, God's overall plan. In verse 22, "I've given you one portion above your brothers." As I said, Joseph gets a double portion divided between Ephraim and Manasseh. What it says after that causes some question. It says, "which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow." Do you remember reading about Jacob fighting with a sword and bow with the Amorites? Neither do I. There's not a biblical record of that. Could be one of those things where just wasn't that important for God to make it part of Genesis. I've read speculation. One of the most popular speculations is that, remember the land that Jacob bought at Shechem? He actually bought land there before the Dinah incident. Some speculate that he was away for a while and the Amorites seized it, so he came and there was a fight to take it. But it's pure speculation. But it could be, if that's true, it could refer, let me give cite John chapter 4 and verse 5. John 4 verse 5 references Jacob giving a plot of ground to Joseph near the town that was in John called Sychar. And some scholars think, well, maybe that's the derivative of Shechem, and Jacob gave Joseph some land. It seems to fit. That's the only place where the Bible account says that he had land. So, and it's one of those things, if not, we don't really need to know, but I like to be able to answer trivia questions about stuff. Okay, so we move on. We could do this without a chapter break, although the chapters would get really long, because here in the beginning of 49, it says, "Jacob called his sons, 'Gather together that I may tell you what will befall in the last days.'" The way I see this is, you know, if you don't look at the big 49 there near the margin, you think, okay, Jacob's there in his bedroom and Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh have come in, but in the outer room, all the other brothers are there. At the same time, a messenger went to tell Joseph, "Hey, your father's sick, I think he's dying." Probably messengers went to all the brothers and said the same thing. So Jacob has this private time with Joseph and his two sons, but then says, "Bring the rest of the family in. I want to talk to all of them." And so they all come in. I picture they're crowding around and Joseph sitting there on the side of his bed. And he says, "I'm going to tell you what will befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father." Last days. Does that have meaning? Okay, that's on that list of terms that I gave. It seems to refer not to the last days of these living men, but the last days of this era meaning shortly before Christ returns. And I think that's the proper indication, because everything we read later tells us these guys finished living their lives there in Egypt, and none of what we see in chapter 49 pertained. There are New Testament references that use that term last days, like 1 Timothy 3, verse 1, where it says, in the last days, perilous times will come. You know, that was 1 Timothy 3, 1. Also 2 Peter 3, 3, where it says, scoffers will come in the last days. And I'm just giving this to show that, again, I think these are prophecies for not necessarily the day of the Lord, but this period of time. I think our common understanding is that we've seen these fulfilled in recent decades or the last couple centuries even. Okay. And I'll move on. Before I start reading and giving some possible interpretations, you might have an edition that shows this is written in verse form as poetry. And anybody not have that? Then it doesn't matter, some editions of the Bible. So we believe it was written as poetry, and you've been learning a bit about how the Hebrews wrote poetry. That shows there was some figurative language, probably some symbolism, and some things that just aren't entirely clear. And that's something we want to keep in mind. There's a lot here that it had meaning, and I don't want to say it didn't, but some of it we're not sure of the meaning. I've heard this described, you know, where did the 10 lost tribes go? Because we know from our study in, you know, later in the Bible that Israel would be conquered, those people taken off, and they lost their identity. Judah, which had the tribe of Benjamin with them, and most or a large part of Levi, largely kept their identity. Okay, but where did the 10 tribes go? You know, I've read some people believe that they ended up in North America, and the American Indians were the descendants of the lost 10 tribes. You know, I don't find that to be very believable, but for other reasons. You know, our common belief in the Church of God has been that they've been found in what we call Northwest Europe. And I think that's probably true. I've seen some speculation that all of it was within what we call the British Isles, that there's different sects, or not different ethnic groups within the British Isles that might represent that, you know, all of the 12 tribes. And maybe, to me that seems limiting it quite a bit. So I want to go forward and look at some of these, and I'll mention some of who we think these might be. But one thing, if this is for the last days, then that indicates that these individual tribes would be a recognizable group of people. They wouldn't be some here, some there, all over, except specifically Levi and Simeon, who he does say will be scattered. So somewhere on the face of the globe today, there's probably a nation or part of a nation that's mostly the descendants of Reuben. Somewhere the descendants of Gad are, and probably as a nation or an ethnic group, and so on through all of them. Does that make sense? That's the way we interpret the prophecy. One other thing before we dive in. Moses gave a similar prophecy, but not as much detail, in Deuteronomy chapter 33. So in Deuteronomy 33, Moses will address the tribes one at a time, like Jacob does here. Okay, so in verse 3, Reuben, you're my firstborn, my might, the beginning of my strength, excellency of dignity, excellency of power, but unstable as water. You won't excel. Why? You went up to your father's bed. He's reminding him of that incident with Bilhah, his concubine. Okay, because of the adultery with Bilhah, by the way, that's Genesis 35, verse 22, if you want the reference, and also 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 and 2. Interestingly, and I didn't notice this until I was doing study for this class, if you look through the rest of the Bible, you won't find a king or a prophet who was descended from Reuben. That's not to say all the Reubenites were no good, you know, worthless, but none of the great leaders of Israel came from them. A common teaching in the church has been that the Reubenites became the people that are now primarily in what we call northwestern France, or even northern France. Some people just say France, which is generalizing a bit because there are different groups within what is now the nation of France. Moving on in verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brothers. So he groups them together. Instruments of cruelty. Let my soul not enter into their counsel, lest let not my honor be united their assembly. In their anger they slew a man, in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed is their anger, it's fierce. He seems to be referring primarily to the slaughter at Shechem. And again, referencing the incident with Dinah, where it's mentioned Simeon and Levi went in after all the men were sore because they'd been circumcised and just started swinging the swords. But some of this might indicate other things. That seems to be their nature. These guys were kind of mean, it seems. So their descendants are destined to not remain identifiable peoples. You know, they're going to be scattered. I didn't read that part. At the end of verse 7 says, I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. The Levites ended up having this turn to good, you could say, because later the Levites will become the priestly family. But they won't inherit a territory like all the other tribes did. I'm sure you covered this in Judges or in Joshua. They'll be given towns all through Israel. Now, many of the Levites, we don't know, most people think it was a majority, but when the nation split, Israel and Judah, since the northern kingdom left worshiping the true God, the Levites are kind of out of a job. So it's believed many of the Levites went to Judah and stayed there. And thus, many people who today identify themselves as Jewish may well be Levite. And we don't have a way of knowing. But one indication that helps with this, a common Jewish last name is Cohen, which is the Hebrew for priest, if I remember. Dr. Britt is... Yeah, and so I wouldn't say for certain, but there's speculation that that last name might indicate someone who's descended from Levi rather than Judah. But notice I'm saying might and could be. I wouldn't say any of that with definition. What about the Simeonites? Don't have any indication there. Had an interesting discussion with people. I've heard some people speculate that maybe the Simeonites became... I don't want to say this in a way that's insulting unless it would come across, but keep in mind I come from South... My family comes from southwestern Ohio, and that I've had two or three times in my life where I lived in trailer homes. Because I say, some people speculate the Simeonites were what some people call rednecks today. That you've got certain types of people in all these nations, but that's pure speculation based on nothing. But it can make some interesting, you know, it can make amusing talk, but don't take it for anything more than that. I've never heard a speculation of anything greater than that, though. So it goes to show when Jacob said, you're going to be scattered, they got scattered. We just don't know where they are, but they're mixed in. I've also heard people say maybe God scattered them for the good of the other nations. It's like you get too many of these people together, it's going to be trouble. And you see that sometimes with a group of people. You get them together and pretty soon it's like explosive. Okay, beginning in verse 8. Verses 8 through 12 is all about Judah. And Judah, remember the name means praise. And I should have mentioned a number of these poetic references make plays on the meaning of the names, which makes for good poetry, but sometimes leaves us wondering, what in the world does it mean? But for Judah, it's not so hard. His name means praise. You are he whom your brothers will praise. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies, and goes on. Judah is described early as a lion's whelp, like a young lion, and then it moves on to describe him as an old lion who's settled down and who's going to dare rouse him. So, which might match the progression that we saw in Judah's life, where he's seemed to be a little rebellious troublemaker and then becomes very responsible. In verse 10, we see a prophetic reference. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. To him shall be the obedience of the people. Okay, this includes, this is what we call the scepter promise. Okay, the scepter refers to rulership. And King David would be a Jew. And so the rulers of Judah would be Jews, and eventually Jesus Christ would be. Shiloh, along with being a cool Neil Diamond song, has some meaning. Scholars debate. Some say this it could be interpreted as peaceful and prosperous one. I've got three possible references. Peaceful and prosperous one. Another interpretation is that it's a reference meaning Savior. But the most literal interpretation means to him whom it belongs, or to whom it belongs. And that seems to be the literal meaning. So it talks about the scepter won't be depart until him to whom it belong comes. An interesting thing, and I think it's more working backwards, because this Shiloh and this prophecy seems to be a messianic prophecy. Seems clearly to be referring to Jesus Christ, who was a peaceful and a prosperous one, who certainly was the Savior. And you could make the case even more strongly, he's the one to whom the scepter belongs. He's the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. So this seems to be, again, a prophecy of Jesus Christ. And we see that following in verse 11, binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. That is echoed in a messianic prophecy that's in Zechariah 9 and verse 9. I won't turn there and read it for sake of time, but so it's Zechariah 9, 9. And then also, it goes on to say, he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. That seems to be echoed in a messianic prophecy that we have read in Isaiah 63. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 3, that is also then referred to in Revelation about treading the winepress and the blood coming out to the horse's bridle. So, again, it seems that God inspired this in Jacob. How much Jacob understood what it meant, we don't know. Keep in mind what we mentioned last time in 1 Peter, how he's describing that the prophets sometimes didn't fully understand the meaning of their prophecies. They're prophecies for us. Okay, I'm going to pause. Catch my breath. Questions? I know I'm going kind of fast, but yes. Judah literally means praise. So it's like a play on words when he says, you are him whom your brothers will praise. And if you want to go back, remember when Rachel and Leah are having this competition of who can have the kids, and they're given the boys' names to sort of point out that competition. So, too bad if, like your name means for hire or something like that, because Leah said, I'm getting my love for hire from my husband because of the mandrakes or that kind of thing. Okay, looking to verse 13 then. Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea and become a haven for ships. His border shall adjoin Sidon, which we think is Sidon. Interestingly, I've seen some scholars to say, yeah, Zebulun was given land along the Mediterranean, and others look at the description in Judges and say, no, he wasn't. It was not that close. And they say this was an ironic reference. So I think it depends on how someone tries to figure out the map. But looking to the end time, a common speculation is that the descendants of Zebulun became the Dutch peoples who live in the nation now known as the Netherlands, commonly referred to by Americans as Holland. So we get all these names. Netherlands is the official name of the country, which means low country, because half of it was underwater before they built the dikes and the pumps and such. And they were a great seafaring people in what we call the early modern period. The 1400s and 1500s, the Dutch were building an empire to rival the Spanish till the Spanish and the Americans and French sort of pushed them out of the way. Moving on to verse 14. Issachar is a strong donkey lying between two burdens. Saw the rest was good, land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. Well, that doesn't sound nice. If I were Issachar hearing that, I'd say, huh. But scholars say that the original Hebrew here is actually rather vague. And they say that another interpretation that this could have is just saying that Issachar would be willing to work hard and to pay taxes, and not necessarily implying slavery, but pretty much, being under tribute and willing. And I kind of like that better. And a common speculation is that the people of Issachar, the descendants, can be found in what is now Finland. And I know a lot of this goes back to research that Dr. Herman Hay did way back in the 30s and 40s, and others have followed up on that. So when I'm saying some people speculate, I say that because it's out there and it might well be true, but the historical evidence isn't such that I'd hang my hat on it. But I don't have historical evidence to say that's absolutely wrong, and I know it. So you can take that for what it means, or what you take it. Moving on with Dan. Verse 16, Dan will judge the people as one of the tribes of Israel. He'll be a serpent in the way, a viper in the path that bites the horse's heel. And it goes on. So this seems to refer to the people of Dan using like cunning and surprise. Some people also, especially if you do the tribe tracking method, They refer to the story in Judges. Remember in Judges 18 where Dan said, we don't have enough room, we got to find a place to live. And they find that town up north and they go just slaughter all the people and rename the town Dan after their tribal father. Well, it doesn't say that they ever named anything again Dan, but there are things, a lot of places with the name Dan or Don or Den in them. And remember, the Hebrew doesn't use vowels. So some have said, yeah, the Danites left a trail across, you know, Asia and Europe as they migrated, naming things after their father. Well, maybe so. The one thing I'd say is, if you have the letters D and N together, those are two really easy letters to pronounce, and they came out pretty naturally, right? It'd be like saying Danny is a Danite because of her name. Has to be, right? Or I'm a descendant of Benjamin Franklin because my name is Frank. So I hesitate over linguistic evidence just because it's not as absolute as a document that somebody signs. But saying that I hesitate doesn't mean I know that it's not true or that it necessarily isn't. And having said that, you know, some people have put the descendants of Dan in Denmark. Say, well, that must be where they are. But I've heard much more speculation saying they settled in Ireland, which has nothing to do with the name Dan. And some people say, well, the compromise would be there in both places. Moving on in verse 19, Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he'll triumph at last. Out of all the 12, this is probably the most obscure. And the one thing I say, well, it sounds encouraging in the end, you know. So at least he gets the tramping in the last. And the most common speculation I've heard for a modern identity is in Switzerland, which sounds cool, except when you look at Switzerland and it has these four different ethnic groups and four different languages. So again, I hesitate to be very dogmatic, but I do want to share with you what some of the common teachings have been. Verse 20, bread from Asher shall be rich and shall yield royal dainties. Okay, that sounds like Asher knew how to cook. Asher, in ancient times in Israel, inherited some of the most fertile land. And some have interpreted this to mean that in the future, their descendants would have some of the most fertile land in Europe. And they placed their people in what is now Belgium or the part of France adjoining. And remember, Belgium hasn't been a nation for as long as many others. So that part of Western Europe that consists of Belgium and France, which is very fertile, wonderful farmland, and from what I understand, people there know how to cook. At least last time I went to a French restaurant, I was convinced. So let's move on. Verse 21, we begin the prophecy. Oh, well, no, we're not getting to Joseph yet. We got Naphtali. Or Naphtali. So I'm not even close. Okay, Naphtali, or Naphtali, if you're an old codger like me, says, will be a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. And some scholars say the Hebrew here might be referring to a deer's antlers growing and spreading out, or to a plant branching out if it's not the deer. Either way, it suggests inheriting a fertile land and prospering. So again, take the symbolic language perhaps to relating to fertile, prosperous land. Yes?
How do they get that much out of just two lines of words? Like, that has to be pretty high speculation.
There's a fair bit. Well, some of the language, like, okay, a deer let loose, they're sort of saying the word for let loose might refer to running apart. See, some words have, and deer's antlers grow apart. So they said, maybe that's what it's trying to say. You know, from my understanding is some where they do say more, it's easier to be clear. And some of these where it's real short, it's a fair bit of speculation. And I'm willing to admit that. Some have suggested that Naphtali settled in what is now Sweden, which, although it's cold, is a pretty fertile land, you know, as long as it's not on a cliffside. Is it Norway has the fjords? Yeah, so Sweden, I think, has more good land. Either way, I'd like to go visit, but haven't. Okay, verses 22 through 26 address Joseph. So remember, Ephraim and Manasseh hold that place, but Jacob gives the prophecy that will apply to both, it seems. And they're very rich blessings. I'm not going to read all of this, but one thing I'll mention is that We look largely to other places to identify the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh as what we now call the English-speaking peoples. And having done that, it's easier to look back and put some interpretation on some of these prophecies. So if you see what I mean, I'm sort of backing in saying, well, since we already know these are England and U.S. and British Commonwealth, it's easier to understand what these mean. If we were wrong about the former, then the latter might not make as much sense. But like in verse 22, a fruitful bough, his branches run over the wall. We've interpreted that to refer to establishing colonies. And both, especially Britain, went out and established colonies, which is one of the reasons we live where we do, and also conquered peoples and established rule. The United States hasn't colonized as much, but then again, if you think about the westward expansion across the continent, could have referred to that. And also, you know, taking over places like Hawaii and Guam and the Philippines. Down in verse 25, it refers to the blessings of the deep that lie beneath. I'm skipping ahead. Blessings of the deep might well refer to mineral wealth, digging mines and pulling out, you know, iron ore, gold, silver, coal. Lots of that in the United States, but Britain also. And they were a chief producer of coal and steel before America was in the business. It goes on to mention blessings of the breast and the womb, which seems to refer to a large population, you know, having a lot of kids, and perhaps also to large population of livestock, which has been true. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. You know, that sounds far-reaching. It might well refer to the worldwide territorial control that the U.S. and Britain have exercised. You might have heard of the phrase, the sun never sets on the British Empire. And it's questionable if that's quite true today, but in the 1800s it was very true. You know, because Britain held land all around the world, and the United States has gone on to have territorial control around the world. So you go back later, the language itself is kind of neat if you think, hey, that's me, I'm getting all this. But let's wrap up the tribes. Verse 27, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he'll divide the spoil. This seems to refer to Benjamin's warlike tendencies and fighting prowess. Which, boy, you know, we see some evidence of that in the Bible. Remember when Benjamin got in a war with all the other tribes and were holding their own for a while? I've seen speculation that the descendants of Benjamin are chiefly in what is now Norway. I've also seen speculation about Scotland. And of course, those two peoples have intermixed in the past, so that might, you know. And both of them, especially the Scots, they're always fighting. The tradition was in old times, when they weren't fighting an external enemy, they fought each other. And I've got Scots-Irish heritage, so it's not meant as an insult. Okay, questions? Again, pardon me as I move along. So we move on, we go out of poetry form and back into prose. So all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them. And he blessed each one according to his blessing. And he charged them, I'm to be gathered to my people. So I'm going to die. Take me and bury me in the cave that is in the field of Ephron. And he refers back to the remember Abraham buying that cave and the field it's in so that he'd have a place to bury Sarah. And it mentions Abraham's there and he buried Sarah, his wife, there. Isaac is buried. He buried Rebekah. And Jacob says, there I buried Leah and I want to be buried there. Okay, so apparently God gave Jacob the ability to know his end was coming. And then he does, in verse 33, when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet to the bed. So I imagine him sitting like on the edge of the bed, like this, you know. He's done talking, he lays down and dies. Talk about calling your shot or a mic drop moment. I've said my piece, I'm out. You know, and literally he's out. Which, you know, it's kind of cool. He has all his family around him. He gets to say what he wants, and he's looking forward to the resurrection. So it's kind of, you know, it's just not very often that someone gets to go out like that. And of course, then chapter 50 carries on, and the focus is on Joseph. We say, Joseph fell on his father's face and wept and kissed him. I'm guessing the other brothers also wept. But since Joseph has been the focus for the rest of this, you know, up till this point, except for the last couple of chapters, I think that's why it's mentioning him. And he's got the power and wealth and influence. He has them embalm his father. And embalming a body makes sense because otherwise you have to bury it quickly. It's going to start to rot and stink. If you're going to haul it all the way back up to Canaan, embalming is the thing to do. Yes, Emily?
How old were Ephraim and Manasseh when this happened? Do we know that, or is it?
No, well, remember, we know Jacob was in the Promised Land for 17 years before he died. And it seems that Ephraim and Manasseh were probably born before then, although we're not told exactly. So the idea is they were probably teenagers or in their 20s. They might have been as young as, you know, around 10, 12. There's room because they're mentioned earlier, but we don't know, were they born during the 7 years of plenty or during the 7 years of famine? And the 7 years of famine, five of those years overlap with Jacob's 17. So do you see what I mean? But it seems that they'd have to be at least around the age of 15. So when it says Jacob brought him from between his knees, maybe that's more figurative speaking, unless they were dwarfs. But yeah, it's sort of like, remember, Benjamin keeps being referred to as the lad who is father, and it turns out he's like father of eight kids, you know. He's young, relatively speaking. And that's the case for these guys. They're relatively young. Consider Jacob's 137 years old. So, yeah, these guys are little kids. They're only 20. Sorry, I didn't mean to make a big deal of it, but okay, so we got the embalming, you know, and that's going to make it possible to take him. It mentions 40 days for embalming. I'm glad it doesn't take that long today. I'm not sure. And the Egyptians mourned him 70 days. That might include the 40 days of embalming. So it might have been the embalming and then a 30-day formal mourning period. And I mention that because 30 days seems to be an established thing for someone of great importance. And it does go to show Joseph's prominence, that his dad is considered this great public feature. You know, they'd lower the flags to half staff all across the nation for him. And I'm speaking figuratively. I don't know if they had flags. Verse 4, the days were passed. Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if I found favor, let me go. Dad made me swear to bury him in his burial plot. It's funny, I always thought it odd that Joseph didn't go talk to Pharaoh himself. But there's actually a logical explanation, possibly. It's still guesswork, but if Joseph is in formal mourning, he's probably wearing mourning clothes, like black, and maybe he's not wearing his normal, you know, I was going to say ointments, perfumes, deodorant. So anyways, in that state, it's not proper for him to come in Pharaoh's presence, so he has other officials go make the request. And of course, it's important also, he doesn't just leave without asking permission. Because although he's a high official, Pharaoh is the boss. That's something I found interesting. You know, when I was reading History of World War II that Winston Churchill wrote, you know, he's running the government of Britain during the war, and he had to travel out of the country to meet with other leaders, but he never left without getting the king's permission. And I didn't learn that till I read his biography. Now, the king, of course, granted it, but Churchill went through that proper channel, and we see an example of Joseph doing that. And Joseph doesn't go alone, a whole bunch goes. Verse 7, Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, all the house of Joseph. They left the little ones, so the babies and the animals stay behind. And it seems like a bunch of Egyptians went. Again, showing the respect that they had for Joseph and his family. Verse 9, they went up chariots and horsemen. It was a great gathering. They came to the threshing floor of Atad, or Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and mourned. I always thought that it must be Atad was the guy who owned the threshing floor. But that word could be translated to mean brambles or thorns. So threshing floor of Atad could be the threshing floor near brambles. It might be the place name rather than the owner. And it doesn't matter to anybody unless you're preparing to teach a class. Okay, so they go up, they observe 7 days of mourning. Verse 11, the inhabitants of the land saw this thing and they said, this is a deep mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore, it's called Ebel Mizraim. Mizraim refers to Egyptian in that language. So they see all these people dressed like Egyptians and a lot speaking the Egyptian language. They assume that they're all Egyptian, it seems, rather than, oh, there's some Hebrews and Egyptians. Again, not something that matters for us in particular. So Joseph carries out Jacob's last wish, buries him in this place. And remember, Abraham and Sarah are there, Isaac and Rebecca, Leah's there. And we sometimes wonder, what's it going to be like when the resurrection comes, all those people together? Yeah. Assuming they recognize each other. Now we move on. There's one last thing to talk about, though. Verse 15, when Joseph's brother saw their dad was dead, well, maybe Joseph's going to hate us and get revenge on us. They're a little concerned. So they send this message. They sent messages to Joseph, verse 16, saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus speak to Joseph. I beg you to forgive the trespass of your brothers, their sin. They did evil to you. Please forgive the trespass." And then the brothers, so first they send a message saying, "Dad asked you to forgive us." Then in verse 18, we see they went and they asked for forgiveness. What we can tend to overlook is it's been 17 years since they saw each other and Joseph said it was okay. You wonder, it's like, are they that worried? Well, they did do him pretty bad. And you wonder, there's speculation, did Jacob really give that message or did they just come up with that as a story to try to get on Joseph's good side? And we don't know for sure. One thing I could think of, remember when Esau was so mad he wanted to kill Jacob for stealing his birthright? But he said, "I'm going to wait till Dad dies." You know, so maybe that's the thought of this. Maybe Joseph's just waiting till Dad dies and then he's going to let us have it. Well, we see the true forgiveness that Joseph felt. That wasn't at all his thinking. And he lets him know. He says, verse 19, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive." Again, think of Romans 8:28. All things work together for good to those who fear God. So Jacob, Joseph really believed that and practiced it. Okay, let's wrap this up, if you'll give me a moment. So Joseph dwelled in Egypt, his father's household. Joseph saw Ephraim's children, the third generation, the children of Machir. Joseph said, "I'm dying. God will bring you out." So Joseph wants his body to be taken back. And we'll see later that it was. I can give you some references here. So Joseph will be embalmed. Exodus 13, verse 19. Exodus 13, 19 will show that Moses made sure they took Joseph's body. And then in Joshua 24, verse 32, Joshua 24, 32 shows that they did bury him there. And some people have speculated that they might have taken all of the 12 brothers, although the Bible is not as clear on that. I will mention Joseph, when we see the years of his life, he lived 80 years after becoming prime minister and being released from prison. So, you know, he had those years. He was sold as a slave. He worked for Potiphar. He was in jail. Then suddenly he's made the prime minister. We don't know if he was in charge of the country for all that time. If so, what a long tenure. But he seemed to have maintained prominence and had wealth. And the Israelites had begun multiplying rapidly, even while he was still alive. And we'll see that when we turn the page and start in Exodus.